People who have listened to this audio podcast have heard me and several guests talk about how fear doesn't appear to work in emergency management messaging. How for years, we've seen fear used to no avail and in ways that seem, well, cheesy or uncomfortably manipulative. It's not difficult to see, however, that fear surrounds us and plays a large part in our advertising culture and thus our behavior. Politicians want us to fear their opponents. Insurance companies want us to fear loss. Auto repair shops want us to fear breakdowns. Our kids want us to fear that other parents are better. So with a fear that my view on fear-based messaging just didn't add up, I went to go speak to a doctor, a former professor, program director, and longstanding leader in risk communication consulting. Dr. Peter Sandman received his PhD in communication from Stanford University in 1971. He went on to teach at Rutgers University for almost 20 years and founded an environmental communication research program during the height of the NIMBY era, when people were saying to plants and factories in their neighborhood about pollution, both real and perceived, "Not in my backyard." He's written over 80 articles and books and consulted around the globe. He says that fear-based appeals do indeed work, but with more than a few important exceptions. In this episode of the Complete EM podcast, Dr. Sandman reminds that fear works, but that there's a quantum of fear, a limit to which people will react in ways that emergency managers intend. Audiences are also comprised of many types of people. So, for example, fear can motivate apathetic people to desired action and simultaneously drive those in denial to more negative behaviors. He also points out that fear-based appeals do little good if they don't include instructions, ideally a range of alternative instructions, and that generally, elevating and diminishing fear, two outcomes emergency managers intend at different times, requires different tools and techniques. I first became acquainted with Dr. Sandman in the late 1990s. He came to advise a group of my colleagues as we prepared a state for Y2K. Since then, he's assembled an amazing body of work on his website at psandman.com. Among many questions, I asked him what we've learned about risk communication over the past 30 years and found one of his answers particularly remarkable, insofar as it seems to apply to both risk communication and emergency management professions. He said that although things were changing in risk communication, we still may be at a point where the art still outperforms the available science.
For thousands of years throughout history, it was pretty much obvious to everybody that fear appeals make sense. That, you know, if your problem is that people aren't taking a precaution, and your guess is the reason they're not taking the precaution is because they're not worried enough, they're not upset enough, they're not frightened enough, then it seemed pretty obvious to everybody that you try to get them worried, try to get them upset, try to get them frightened. And, you know, the most obvious thing in the world, it's obvious to every parent. It was obvious to, you know, every one of the ancient Greeks that wrote on persuasion. Is, you know, fear appeals are a key tool in your toolkit when people aren't taking a precaution and you want them to. And everybody sort of thought that was self-evident. And it all changed, I think, very suddenly in 1953, when there was a study done by the Hublin Group at Yale University, famous group of researchers that were trying to put more science into persuasion and figure out rather than guessing what works, actually study what works. And they did a very famous study on how to scare children into brushing their teeth. And one of the treatments was a very frightening message. I think it was a movie, a very frightening message about all the horrible things that will happen to you if you don't brush your teeth. And they had the whine of the dentist drill, that they had, you know, close-up photos of rotting teeth. And it was a vivid fear appeal aimed at convincing kids that, you know, basically aimed at terrifying kids into brushing their teeth. And they studied the effect of that movie versus the control group. I don't remember if the control group was no message at all or a much milder message. But in any case, the movie backfired. The fear appeal not only didn't work, it actually, you know, kids actually brushed their teeth less after watching that movie than they did in the control group. And when they asked the kids why, the kids had a very sensible answer. They said, look, every time I brush my teeth, it reminds me of that terrifying movie. And in order not to think of that terrifying movie, I don't brush my teeth. And it was a perfectly good study, and it was perfectly clear from that study that the fear appeal had boomeranged. And that study, that group was famous, and that study became famous, and an entire generation of psychologists concluded that fear appeals don't work. And, you know, when I took a course in persuasion theory as an undergraduate in the 1960s, I was taught that fear appeals don't work. And it was based basically on that study. And that was considered to be, you know, the science, the finding that, you know, maybe, you know, in follow-up studies, they concluded, look, mild fear appeals probably work, you know, but there's a curvilinear relationship. And when you frighten two people too much, you know, in order not to be frightened, they avoid thinking about the issue. And if you're trying to get them to do something that requires them to think about the issue, the fear appeal is going to backfire. And that, you know, that became the conventional wisdom. And then the correction began in the 1980s. You know, a good 25 years later, in the mid-1980s, there were two meta-analyses done of all the fear appeal studies. And those meta-analyses found that, you know, lo and behold, fear appeals work. And the relationship is not curvilinear, it's linear. The more you scare people, the more frightened they get. And that became the new wisdom, and that is still the new wisdom. So that, you know, from the mid-1980s right through to today, another 30 years, another generation, it's now the conventional wisdom that you're wrong, and that fear appeals are very effective. And you'll get a footnote that says, well, maybe really extreme fear appeals don't work. You know, it's possible that fear appeals backfire if you frighten people too much. But don't worry about it, because it's hard to frighten people that much. And as scary as you're likely to be able to get, the scarier you are, the more behavior change you will get. That's now the conventional wisdom.
Is there a direct relationship between the level of fear that people feel and the behavior that they're willing to change? Are you saying that the more scared people are, the more receptive they are to change behavior?
I think the question is a good one. The main, you know, the main thread of the research suggests that, you know, I mean, it's all grounded in trying to get apathetic people to be less apathetic. So the underlying assumption is your audience is really uninterested, and you are trying to get them interested, and fear, and you're trying to get them to do something grounded in their interest. And scaring them is very effective, and the more you scare them, the more likely they are to behave. What underlies your question, I think, and it's a really good question, is what if they're already scared? And I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, if people, you know, are already scared of the thing you're trying to scare them about, then scaring them is either going to be not terribly useful, because, you know, what it's trying to accomplish has already been accomplished, or even backfiring if it pushes them even further into their fear. And well, we certainly have to talk about denial. I have a list of exceptions to the general principle that fear appeals work, and one of the exceptions for sure is denial.
These are cases where fear doesn't work?
Situations or concerns that might lead you to try something other than a fear appeal. The first one, which is easy, and let me just get it out of the way, is when people are completely unaware of the risk, they never heard of it, then a fear appeal is premature. And everybody pretty much agrees that fear appeals are designed for, you know, when people are aware of the risk but not very worried about it, and you're trying to get them more worried about it. And if they're not yet aware of the risk, you've got to make, you know, you've got to tell them what it is and what it's all about before you try to scare them.
So, for example, it's not good enough to say, hey, watch out for Zika. It could really do damage. You have to do a little background on that and share what that is with folks.
Exactly. There's just no point in scaring people about Zika when they never heard of Zika. it's premature. So that one's an easy one. The second one is much more important, and that's the one that you were raising, which is when people are already too frightened. I don't worry much, and the literature doesn't worry much, that you can, through with a fear appeal, overshoot the mark, that you can push people all the way from apathy into denial. I think that's very hard to accomplish with something as weak and ephemeral as messaging. So with rare exceptions, I really don't think that's a problem. But a real problem is when people are already very frightened. And when people are already very frightened, then the odds that a fear appeal will push them into denial, and the chances of that are real. And the thing to understand about denial is, I mean, denial looks like apathy, but it's the opposite of apathy. People in denial will claim to be apathetic, but what's really going on is they're too frightened to bear it, and they have tripped some kind of internal switch, like a circuit breaker, to protect them from excessive fear. And that circuit breaker has been deployed, and now they're copacetic, but they're not copacetic because they're apathetic. They're copacetic because they couldn't take the level of fear they were experiencing. And it's just no question that denial is real. It's not super common. I mean, you know, as I used to put it to audiences, you know, apathy is the horse and denial is the zebra. Denial is a whole lot less common than apathy. But if you're facing denial and you don't know it and you think you're facing apathy, you're gonna make the situation worse. That was true, for example, classically true during the Cold War when people, you know, activists trying to push for nuclear disarmament would, you know, talk about, you know, nuclear war scenarios. And Helen Caldicott would famously give speeches, you know, about, you know, if a nuclear bomb were dropped right here, right now on this city, here's what would happen. Then, you know, here's how many people would die instantly and how many people would be, you know, incredibly, you know, burned and, you know, running through the streets in agony. And, you know, and she had a spectacular speech, which she thought was going to scare people into becoming anti-nuclear activists. And it overwhelmingly scared people into being unwilling to think about the possibility of a nuclear exchange. So she, you know, I mean, because people were already so frightened, her fear appeal, instead of frightening apathetic people, pushed people who were already in denial more deeply into denial.
As evidenced by, like, just being dismissive about it, or was there some other sort of general behavior that came about because of that?
Well, I mean, there are people who experience real distress, but most, you know, I mean, if your defense system works properly, denial defends you from excessive fear. I mean, you know, I mean, essentially, denial is a protection against panic. You know, so I mean, if people are at risk of panicking, I mean, the reason, or at least one of the reasons panic is rare, is that people are at risk of panicking, they trip that circuit breaker and go into denial instead.
Yeah.
And then mostly, you know, if they're healthy people, they then look and feel apathetic, you know, and it's your job as the communicator to suss out that it looks and feels like apathy, but it isn't apathy, it's denial. And so the prescription is entirely different, and fear appeals are going to backfire. I mean, another classic example is women's breast self-examination, you know, where, you know, it's not the case that there are a lot of women in developed countries like the U.S., who are apathetic about breast cancer. So, you know, fear appeals in breast cancer messaging don't work very well because you're not mostly talking to an apathetic audience, you're mostly talking to a frightened audience, and the fear appeal is too likely to trip that circuit breaker.
So in the lead up to Y2K, that non-disaster we had about 15, 16 years ago, I was working in a state operations center, emergency operations center with a staff, I mean, we were mostly, I'd say, sort of later Gen Xers, and I was getting my team ready for the possibility that there might be an accidental missile launch. And, you know, and I grew up in the era with, you know, where we were taught to climb underneath the desks at school if we happened to hear an alarm, and, you know, expecting the mushroom cloud and that sort of thing. And so I gave a little bit of, you know, that sort of speech to my team. And I was surprised, probably my brightest member of that team said, you know, I'm not going to relocate. I'm going to drive down to the Capitol and I'm going to just wait for the missile to come. Is that, mm-hmm. is that the apathy that you're talking about, or is that something else?
It's a kissing cousin of denial. You know, I mean, the classic bend over and kiss your ass goodbye as the proper response to a nuclear exchange. It's a kind of paralysis. It's a kind of fatalism. I mean, those are all kissing cousins of denial. They're all, you know, ways of not panicking in response to excessive fear. And of course, this is relevant to earthquakes, which is, you know, one of your main interests. I mean, if you've got an audience of people who are already terrified of earthquakes, but they have to live in Southern California because, you know, that's where their child is going to high school, or that's where their job is, or where their spouse's job is. And living in Southern California is already putting them on the knife edge of intolerable fear because they're so scared of earthquakes. But being healthy people, they manage not to think about it most of the time, and they work hard not to think about it most of the time. And then you come along and try and scare them about earthquakes as if they were apathetic, and what they really are is just barely coping with very high levels of fear, then you're going to push them more deeply into denial.
When I go back east and folks ask me about earthquakes, I'm the one that's not concerned about earthquakes. They're the ones that express concern about earthquakes. And I find myself more concerned about, you know, what would I do if a tornado or something happened?
Everybody enjoys other people's risks. you know, it's very easy if you live on the East Coast to have a pleasurable frisson of fear about earthquakes, because you kind of know you're not in an earthquake zone. You know, and you can talk to your California friends about how I would never live in California because, you know, I wouldn't want to live where there's an earthquake. And, you know as well as I do what the research says about that. All the people who say they would never live in California because of earthquakes, when they get a job offer in California that they like, they move to California. Maybe they weren't really very scared anyway. They were just pretending to be. Or maybe they were genuinely worried about earthquakes. And when they get to California, they work hard to put it out of their mind. And that's kind of what the denial exception is all about. I mean, insofar as you've got an audience of people who are already frightened and just barely coping with their fear, then I would, you know, and I don't know if that's a tiny audience or a huge audience, but it certainly exists. And that's an audience for whom earthquakes are somewhere between ineffective and backfiring.
And from a researcher point of view, is there a good level of steady state fear in the, can I say general population? Should we as emergency managers be aware of the fact that there is a normal state of regular fear?
The short answer is yes. There is essentially, now this is not a phrase that's in common use, but I think it makes perfectly good sense. There is a law of conservation of fear. You know, different people are more or less fearful than other people. You may be more fearful than your spouse or less fearful than your spouse, but you're probably not as a person more fearful than you were last month or less fearful than you were last month. I mean, there may be very, very slow changes as we age. But in general, you know, our level of fearfulness is pretty close to a constant, except for emergencies. You know, and in an emergency, you know, I mean, the amygdala pumps out, the body pumps out various kinds of hormones and other biochemical reactions happen and things change in the brain. And suddenly we have, you know, we are more frightened and, you know, we're more primed to cope with our fear. We're, you know, we're energized. We're not sleepy anymore. You know, we put our normal activities aside and we go into, you know, fight or flight mode. We go into emergency mode. So everybody has a high gear to cope with emergencies, but our normal gear doesn't change much from month to month. What changes is how we deploy that, what issues we are fearful about. So in that sense, all fear messaging is competitive. The deodorant industry wants us to be afraid of body odor. The American Cancer Society wants us to be afraid of smoking. The right wing wants us to be afraid of gay marriage. And George wants us to be afraid of earthquakes. And, you know, you're all competing for the same, you know, quantum, you know, and it may be large in some people and small in other people, but it's stable, and you're all competing for it. So if you succeed in getting me more frightened of earthquakes, I will be less frightened of something. You know, I don't know what, but all I'm doing is reallocating my normal fearfulness. Because, your message doesn't create an emergency. An earthquake, a real earthquake, would. But your message won't. All your message does is encourage me to worry more about earthquakes and less about whatever I was worried about yesterday. And there's all kinds of evidence of that. You know, I mean, after 9/11, calls to pollution prevention hotlines plummeted because people were more worried about terrorism, and that necessarily meant they were less worried about pollution.
Yeah.
They only had as much capacity to worry as they had, and that wasn't going to change.
I interrupted you. You were going through six exceptions?
Well, it might even be more than six. I can cherry pick the best ones. One that's important is desensitization. It's absolutely agreed that fear appeals vitiate over time. They become less and less effective. You need stronger and stronger fear appeals. Now, that's issue specific. It's not that our capacity to respond to fear appeals weakens. It's our capacity to respond to fear appeals about a particular issue. You know, so that, you know, the driver ed movies that we all saw in high school got less and less scary as we saw one movie after another after another. And, you know, after you've looked at, you know, 10 or 12 movies of gory traffic accidents, you begin to not be nearly as much influenced by movies of gory traffic accidents. So, you know, desensitization and the diminishing value of fear appeals and the need to escalate the level of fear in your messaging is a real weakness of fear appeals, and suggests that, yeah, they work, but you can't just use them and use them and use them and use them. So that's one. A very big one, or this is really several sort of packaged together, is the notion that people resist being afraid of something if they can't do anything about it. And part of that is that all fear messaging needs to be paired with recommendations about things to do. And it's a whole science there of you know, what, you know, how to suggest solutions or how to suggest actions in ways that are, you know, more or less effective. I mean, for example, it's always more effective to offer people a menu of things to do rather than a single thing to do so that they get to choose. And ideally, the menu has some range in terms of how much trouble they are and how valuable they are. So, one of the things I routinely say to clients is if you're going to recommend some precaution, surround it with less burdensome precautions and more burdensome precautions. So what you're saying is, look, at least do X, even if you think this is a silly issue, even if you're not as worried as I want you to be, you know, at least do X. X is easy and X will help a little. I'm recommending Y. Y is, you know, more hassle than X, and, you know, I might not be able to talk you into Y. Maybe all you're going to do is X. But if you want to follow my advice, do Y. If you think even my advice isn't enough and you feel more vulnerable than most people or you're more worried than most people and you want to go that extra mile, do Z with my blessing. I'm not recommending Z. Z is, you know, too burdensome, and I don't think most people are going to be able to wrap their minds around doing Z. I'd be happy if you just do Y. But if you're out there on the edge and you're more worried about this issue than most people, I'm happy to help you do Z. I'm happy to give you the advice, give you the supplies, whatever it takes. Z is part of my system. And when there's an X and a Y and a Z, you get two benefits. The first benefit is people do more Y when it's surrounded by X and Z. And the second benefit is people who do, and it's particularly with regard to X, but it's true of Z also, people who do the things on the periphery, who do the X or the Z, are defining themselves inside your system. If you only recommend Y and I do X or Z instead, I am telling myself I don't believe you, you're not my guru, I'm not going to take advice from you anymore because you recommended Y and I decided to do X or Z instead. But if you say, Y's my recommendation, but at least do X, or if you want to go at that extra mile, go ahead and do Z, then if I do X or Z, I'm still in your system, I'm still your guy, I'm still real interested in your advice next time. You know, so for both of those reasons, I think that, you know, a very good reason always to give people things to do and always to give people a menu of things to do that vary surrounding your recommendation. On top of that, and really part of the same package, but it, you know, it's worth distinguishing, is messaging about efficacy. There's a lot of evidence that people don't take precautions if they don't think the precaution will do much good, or if they don't feel capable of doing the precaution. And those are two very different kinds of efficacy, but they're both efficacy. The second one is sometimes called self-efficacy in the literature to distinguish it from the first one. But they're both important. So right, and they're both open to messaging. So right up there with telling me, you know, that earthquakes are dangerous, you want to tell me what to do. You want to give me a menu of things to do. And you want to tell me I can do it and it'll help. It's important not to oversell that. You don't want to tell me it'll help more than it really will or more than I'm going to be able to believe it will. And it turns out that, you know, messaging that says it'll only help a little, it's not that great, but it's the best we've got, is pretty effective messaging. You know, I have routinely said to clients, you don't have to say it's going to solve the problem completely in order to persuade people to take a precaution, you know, and if that's not credible and not sustainable and they're going to learn that it doesn't solve the problem completely, that's not the way to go. It's just fine to say it'll help only a little, but, you know, better a little than none at all. But you have to make a case that it's going to help, and you have to make a case that I can do it. I remember working on trying to get people to test their homes for radon back in the day when I was in New Jersey, and radon was a big issue in New Jersey. And people were going door to door, knocking on people's doors and saying, you know, we'd like you to test your home for radon. And if you get a high level, we'll be advising you to do something about it because radon can give you lung cancer. And one of the main barriers to people saying, okay, I will test my home for radon, was a self-efficacy barrier. You know, you knock on someone's door and say, we want you to test your home for radon, and people were thinking, oh, gee, you know, I bet you need a Bunsen burner. I was never very good at science in high school. And people were feeling all kinds of performance anxiety about testing their home for radon. And it was entirely unnecessary. The way you test for your home for radon is you unscrew the canister, wait a week, and then put the top back on and mail it in. So it shouldn't arouse performance anxiety, but the concept of testing your home for radon sounded like science and scared people. So that was a very straightforward self-efficacy issue, and it turns out that's especially important in fear appeals. People will resist getting scared if they can't think of anything to do, if the things you tell them to do don't sound like they're going to help, or if they don't feel like they're going to be able to do them.
Yeah. I want to jump back for a second and say the obvious. If what we're trying to do as emergency managers with a message is change behavior, that instruction piece that you mentioned absolutely has to go with the fear. Otherwise, folks aren't going to know what to do. The second thing is I want to like dig a little deeper into that comment you made about making sure there's alternatives, X, Y, and Z. What makes people go for Y? Is it ultimately because they're looking to hear what the majority will do and what folks sort of non-compliance might look like? Or is it because people appreciate having the choice? Or is it that essentially what we're doing by laying out X, Y, and Z is we're doing quite a bit of the problem solving for them and sort of thinking through for them out loud the benefits and the costs of each and making a recommendation that way?
I don't know. I mean, my guess would be that it's all of them. I haven't seen research that teased those impacts apart, but, you know, my guess would be that you are saying, you know, you're helping them think, you're giving them a long list, you are involving their capacity to make decisions. And, you know, I mean, everybody knows that, you know, if you make a decision, you have more buy-in than if you're just told what to do. So there's more buy-in. The fact that, you know, your preferred, you know, recommendation is in the middle, that it, you know, there's something worse than it and something better than it, you know, something more burdensome and something less burdensome, makes it seem like the moderate choice. So it's not just your recommendation, it looks like the thing that most people do, even if you don't claim that it's the thing that most people do. You know, if you say at least do X, but we recommend Y, and if you're really a fanatic, go ahead and do Z. You know, you're setting people up to think Y is the standard recommendation. So, on all of those dimensions that you mentioned, I think it helps. I think the most important thing is to have a menu. I mean, I think making one recommendation is really weak. Making a bunch of recommendations so that people get to choose is enormously stronger. And then titrating the choices so that you're saying here are the easy ones, here are the hard ones, here are the middling ones. That's a decided improvement, but that's less important than having a menu. And only really one other sort of exception to fear appeals that I think is really important to mention, and that is there is an audience of people who like to be afraid. And for them, fear appeals work, but they work backwards, you know, not because they're, you know, people are going into denial, but because you're talking to an audience of fear-seeking people. You know, they're not only risk-tolerant, They like being scared. And such an audience exists. You know, I mean, you know, until the government put it out of business, a small independent cigarette company did very well appealing to teenagers with a brand entitled Coffin Nails that was decorated with a skull and crossbones. And, you know, I mean, there was a sizable audience of teenagers that liked the idea of smoking coffin nails and sort of flouting the fear and experiencing the fear. So I doubt that there's an audience that's hoping for, well, at least I doubt there's a large audience that's hoping for earthquakes, but we certainly know with other kinds of natural disasters that, you know, there are people who drive toward rather than away from the path of a hurricane because they want to experience the hurricane. And, you know, when the weather forecaster says this is going to be a really bad one, they're all the likelier to drive into it. So that audience exists. You know, there's not a damn thing you can do about them, except just know that one of the costs of fear appeals is they're going to boomerang on that particular slice of the public.
Do you have a sense of how big that population is?
You know, my intuition is it's small, and it's mostly teenage males.
You know, 18 to 25 or something like that.
Something like that, but that's, you know, that's an intuition, George. I mean, there may be someone who's got data on that, and at least to some extent, it's issue specific. You know, there are people who like, you know, I mean, the people who like hurricanes may not be the same people as the people who like, you know, some other risky situation. But there are certainly people who court risk, whose hobbies are risky, whose occupations are risky. And a fear appeal is just guidance for them on another opportunity to get scared.
Where do procrastinators fall in all of this?
The thing about procrastination is, you know, for some people, it's a life problem. I mean, you know, they procrastinate even on things they care deeply about and things where procrastination is going to cost them dearly. That, you know, they lose their job, they lose their family, they lose, you know, things that are very, very precious to them, you know, and that's, I mean, the psychodynamics of that are very complicated, and I have no idea what's going on with that bunch of people, but for most people, all procrastination means is other things were a higher priority, and, you know, that the combination of other things were a higher priority, and the thing you wanted them to do had some minuses as well as pluses, and, you know, when normal, healthy people who are not, you know, doing seriously self-defeating things, procrastinate on a particular task, it's presumably because, you know, that task had some downsides for them that were meaningful to them, and other things looked like a better cost-benefit trade-off than the thing they procrastinated on. So rather than saying, oh, well, the problem is they're procrastinating, you know, it makes more sense to say, why did I not win the competition to be the thing they did? You know, what do I have to do to make my precaution look, you know, higher on their agenda than the other precautions they took that week instead of mine? And, you know, so I think calling it procrastination gets in the way of diagnosing why you lost the competition. Part of that is simply reminding people. And, you know, Neil Weinstein uses the metaphor of a messy desk, that all recommendations for precautions, unless there's some kind of emergency and they, you know, they go immediately to the top of the list. But most recommendations for precautions, if it's just sort of normally, hey, this is a problem, you ought to do something about it when you get a chance, it just goes on to your messy desk along with all the other things you want to do something about when you get a chance. And then something else comes along, and your note to yourself to take earthquake precautions gets buried under the other notes on your messy desk. And then it just becomes a matter of reminding people. You know, it's not a matter of another fear appeal. It's like, remember you wanted to do that. Let's get it back on top of your list and it'll get covered up again. But every time you pull it up to the top, you know, another cadre of people actually get around to doing it.
So it sounds like for an emergency manager, and I've heard the word, I mean, we use the word procrastinators like all the time, right? It sounds like it's a danger to lump everybody into that category because that may just be masquerading, or not masquerading, but covering up a lot of different conditions, whether it's a group of folks that have sort of exceeded their capacity for fear, Maybe there's other things that are relatively more concerning in their life. Maybe they, all the sort of conditions you laid out beforehand might be combining to look like procrastination. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's right. I mean, except for people for whom procrastination is a major life problem that's getting in the way of their living happy lives. If they're not procrastinators, they're just procrastinating on your issue. That's just normal, and you have to figure out what your issue has to do to win the competition, not blame them for being procrastinators.
Well, you, in your research, and you've taught for many years, you've been around the world lecturing, you've written books on this. In your work, I don't know if you make a distinction, so I'll ask you, is there a difference between fear and the word that you use a lot, outrage?
Well, you know, I invented my sort of signature formula, risk equals hazard plus outrage, at a time when nearly all my work was with environmental risks, and particularly with environmental controversies. And the point I was trying to make was, you know, if you're the neighbor of a factory and the factory is emitting dimethyl meatloaf, and the factory management won't tell you how much dimethyl meatloaf it's emitting and isn't telling the whole truth about what the research results say about whether dimethyl meatloaf might be a carcinogen, and doesn't answer your letters and says contemptuous things when you ask questions at public meetings, and you begin to get a feeling that this factory is run by jerks who are not being good neighbors. And, you know, so, and all of that makes you very inclined to think that dimethyl meatloaf probably is responsible for all the cancer in my community. So, you know, so the thing I was pointing to when I said risk equals hazard plus outrage was that when people are sort of righteously angry at the source of a risk, they are motivated to overestimate the size of that risk. It makes more sense to see their outrage as a component of the risk. The hazard is the technical component, and the outrage is the social component. Because, you know, seeing it that way rather than seeing it as a perception disorder motivates the factory management to stop acting like a jerk. I mean, you know, I mean, what I say to factory management under those circumstances is, if you stop acting like a jerk, people will stop thinking you're killing them. You know, you're drawing the wrong conclusion. You're basically saying, since I'm not killing them, I'm entitled to act like a jerk. And they're saying, you know, since you're acting like a jerk, we're entitled to think you're killing us. And, you just stop acting like a jerk, so they'll stop thinking mistakenly that you're killing them. So I coined the word outrage, and what I had in mind was sort of this righteous anger. And it was exactly the right word for environmental controversies. It's way off as the word for pandemics, where, you know, you're not experiencing righteous anger at the virus. You know, you're frightened of the virus. It's right. Not the right word for earthquakes. You're not experiencing righteous anger at the earthquake. You're frightened about the earthquake. The dynamics are exactly the same. So, you know, so what I now say when I'm working with a public health agency is, you know, what I mean by outrage is all the reactions to the situation that are not reactions to the hazard. You know, everything that isn't a technical response to the hazard is what I'm sort of lumping under the label outrage. And the two principal components are anger and fear. But those aren't the only components. There can be guilt in the mix. There can be shame in the mix. There can be all kinds of other things. But whatever's going on that is, you know, is a response to something real about the risk that isn't, you know, the magnitude of the hazard and the probability of the hazard. It's something else that's real about the risk or about the situation, the context of the risk. That's what I mean by outrage. But if I had it all to do again, I'd choose a word that, you know, worked better in a broader context. The bottom line, outrage is the broader term, and fear is part of outrage, but it's, you know, it's a misleading word, and it's my jargon, and I'm stuck with it.
I think it's quite fitting. It makes total sense the way you explained it. I mean, attaching fear to, you know, about a consequence to a responsible party, particularly in hazmat sort of situations, or, you know, I don't know what the bigger word for that is. We use hazmat all the time. That makes total sense. I'm wondering, to change subjects a little bit here, you've had a chance to help people and organizations through a number of different crises, and you've been able to see us go from Three Mile Island and the 80s with all the hazardous materials things, Y2K, 9/11. And I know this is a big question, so I wonder if you might share with us what it is you think we've learned or should have learned in the past 20, 30 years from these things. Things that we didn't know before the study that you mentioned in the 50s and working through the conclusions of that study in the 50s. What has the last 30 years taught us?
Well, I mean, the big answer to your big question, it seems to me, is insofar as there's a major change, the major change is a growing sense that there's a science here and that we shouldn't be going with intuition alone. I mean, you know, when I started out doing this, the people who worked on the basis of intuition did a better job than the people who relied on the data. The data were quite weak. There wasn't a lot of data. A lot of the studies weren't very reliable. There weren't very defensible theories to explain how persuasion works or how risk communication works. And when risk communication began to emerge as a science, the art and the craft was still ahead of the science. And the people who were best at it didn't know the science, and the people who knew the science weren't drawing enough conclusions to make the science add a lot of value. That's slowly changing. I mean, we could argue about whether it's actually changed yet. And, you know, I mean, there's still a lot of people, you know, and sometimes I'm among them, who go on their, you know, on their intuition honed by, you know, years of experience, even when, you know, there's data that's going the other direction. I mean, you know, people sometimes ask me, what do you do if you read a study that says you're wrong about something basic? And I'm afraid what I do is, besides the study's probably wrong, but I tend to have excessive trust in my own intuition, just like everybody else. But little by little, I think what's happening is, you know, risk communication is becoming a science. Not surprisingly, what I call precaution advocacy, the kind of risk communication you do when people are insufficiently upset, is becoming a science fastest. And, you know, I mean, I think it's now almost, you know, almost considered disreputable to spend millions of dollars on a precaution advocacy campaign, on a campaign to get people to protect themselves from some risk, on a campaign to get people to take earthquake precautions or to prepare for a possible pandemic or to, you know, get vaccinated. To design such a campaign without pre-testing it, without doing focus groups, without stacking it up against the solid research of past campaigns, is beginning to be considered unacceptable, disreputable. There's still an awful lot of agencies that do it, and there are a lot of agencies that can't afford to do careful, meticulous, methodologically solid research, and they're afraid to do, you know, sloppier, seat-of-the-pants formative research, so they don't do any research at all. And that one of my missions is to say to clients, if you can't do great research, do crappy research. It's still enormously more useful than no research at all in helping you figure out whether your campaign is moving in the right direction. So I think the biggest change is that one. The other big change that comes to mind, and, you know, I might have a completely different answer if you ask me the question again tomorrow, but the other big change that comes to mind is in the other side of risk communication, which is to say when people are overreacting to a risk and you're trying to calm them down. And I think there's genuinely a growing awareness that you can't calm people down with data. That when I started out in risk communication, the norm when people were excessively alarmed about some risk that the science said was pretty small, the norm was to tell them the science. And, you know, the assumption was if we explain to them why they're wrong, they'll get it and they'll change their mind and they'll say thank you. And I think there's a growing awareness that that's usually not true, that when people are excessively alarmed about a risk, there are reasons why they're excessively alarmed. Their alarm may be an excessive reaction to the hazard, but it's not an excessive reaction to something in the situation. Something that is frightening them or angering them is real. And telling them the data about the hazard is a profoundly ineffective way to address the outrage. And, you know, I mean, I made my living on that perception, and you know, I sent my children to college on that perception, and I'm going to send my grandchildren to college on that perception. But I think, you know, when I started out saying that, it was considered an innovative, you know, idea. Some people, you know, thought, gee, that's exciting, and I think he's right. And other people thought, that's crazy, we should just keep explaining the science. But I was kind of out there alone saying, wait a minute, when people are more frightened than the science says they should be, don't yell at them that they're being idiots. Figure out what's scaring them, and, you know, or what's angering them and what you're doing wrong, and change it. And I'm no longer alone in saying that. I think that's now kind of universally assumed to be true. So that's a big change. And of course, it's a big change I'm proud of, because I think I was really part of making that change happen.
I may have inferred too much here, but it almost sounded as though you were, to me, that you were saying that, you know, if you look at fear and people's capacity or propensity to sort of take in fear as a needle, that data or other sort of objective information can move that needle up, get people more fearful. But it's an emotional appeal, and non-data appeal that brings it down. Is that what you were saying? Did I get that wrong?
I think that is what I'm saying. That, you know, I mean, fear appeal to apathetic people works, okay? But telling people to calm down when they're frightened doesn't work. You know,
right, okay.
So, you know, I mean, moving people from apathy to, you know, to fear or its wimpy cousin concern, calls for one bunch of strategies, and, you know, and fear appeal is by no means the only strategy. I mean, you know, you can use role modeling, you can use rewards, you can use punishments, you can use cognitive dissonance. There's a whole toolkit. Fear appeals is a key tool in that toolkit, but it's not the only tool. But all of the tools that work for moving people from apathy to action are completely different from the tools that move people from inappropriate action back to apathy. When people are excessively alarmed, it's a completely different toolkit. It has much more to do with listening to them. There's no point in listening to apathetic people. They have nothing to say. But listening to upset people is crucial. You can't tell them anything until they've told you what they're upset about. From the very get-go, the rudiments of calming people down are completely different from the rudiments of riling people up.
All right. And you gave us some examples earlier, but it seems to me like fear surrounds us. Many, many organizations are employing fear campaigns or, you know, incorporating fear into what they're doing. I think the one that's sort of most apparent to me now is the political, you know, the election and politics all around that. Does the strategy and tactics employed by different campaigns, commercial campaigns, political campaigns, is it all the same sort of body of science, and does it easily translate to emergency managers? That is to say, can we look around and see what others are doing and adopt best practices? Or do you think we're living in sort of a special sort of frame with a specific, unique set of clients that for which we need to have a different set of tools?
More the former than the latter. I think, you know, I recently wrote a guest book entry on my website in response to a question. And, you know, the question was, you know, what can Clinton supporters do to persuade Trump supporters that he's too scary to vote for president? And, you know, I mean, I could just as well have answered a question of what could Trump supporters do to persuade Clinton supporters that she's, you know, scary in some way. But the question came, you know, in that direction, and I was happy to, I'd be happy to answer either question, and I took on that question. And, you know, for the most part, most of what I thought about in terms of how do you make Trump scarier so people don't want to vote for him isn't radically different from how do you make earthquakes scarier so that people want to take precautions against earthquakes. I think the science is the same. I think the craft is the same. I think the toolkit is the same. Now, what isn't the same is, or might not be the same, is which strategies you consider usable and which strategies you consider unusable because you don't think they're ethical, or your supporters won't think they're ethical, or journalists won't think they're ethical. I mean, I think you know, in saying science is the same, I'm not necessarily saying that everything that, you know, that Hillary Clinton can get away with saying about Donald Trump, you can get away with saying about earthquakes. Because, you know, I mean, the facts are different and the context is different. The emotional loading is different. There are real differences. But it's the same body of strategy, and it's the same body of science, and it's the same set of tools that you're choosing from. It just might be that, you know, with earthquakes you want to use a 4-iron, and with Trump versus Clinton you want to use a 2-iron.
This has been a wonderful conversation with you, Dr. Sandman. I really appreciate it.
This has been an interesting conversation, and you know, I hope it adds value to your audience.
What is the best way for folks to follow you?
I have a website, www.psandman.com. It's also, if you want, www.petersandman.com. It gets you to the same place. And that website I've been running since, I think, 2000. So I've been running it for 16 years, and it's got things on it from earlier than that, because when I started running it, I put on a whole lot of things that I'd written in my pre-website period. So it's got, you know, enormously more on it than any sane person would want to read. I doubt there's a single person in the universe except me and maybe my wife who has read it all. But it's all there, and it's subdivided according to, you know, sort of my sense of the most important things to subdivide it according to. So there's a separate index for precaution advocacy, for, you know, for risk communication when you're trying to get people to take a risk more seriously. There's an index on outrage management when you're trying to get people to take a risk less seriously. There's an index on crisis communication when people are rightly taking the risk seriously and you're trying to guide them through it. And those are the three paradigms of risk communication as I see them. And then there's a separate index on infectious diseases, because I've, you know, done a lot of work in the last 20 years on infectious diseases, and I decided to set up a separate index on that. So it's all there, and anyone, you know, I mean, it's mostly written, and, you know, anyone who's listened to this conversation knows that I'm long-winded, and the writing is also long-winded, even more long-winded. So, you know, everything is probably longer than most people are accustomed to reading on the web. But as near as I can tell, that, you know, that's the only legacy I'm going to leave. You know, I never created a company. I never created an agency. I don't have, and I left academia, so I don't have, you know, hundreds of former graduate students. All I've got is a website. So if you like what you heard in this conversation, you know, go hang out on the website. And I don't know how much more I'm going to add to the website. I'm 71 and adding less and less all the time. But it's all there, and, you know, hopefully we'll all be there for the foreseeable future.
This concludes another podcast episode by Complete EM. Look for our other episodes, our blog, papers, and a number of other free resources at complete-em.com. We also look forward to your comments and suggestions for improving emergency manager success. Just visit the Contact Us tab and leave us a message at complete-em.com. Thanks for listening.